couple of weeks back, I made a video looking at jazz and how that was pushed in a top-down manner in the 1910s. Then, following week, I made a video about how hip-hop overtook rock, and I looked at the role of the record labels and the money men, and in particular, a guy called Doug Morris, who was the CEO of Universal. And then, this was a reasonably, both of them were reasonably popular videos, with some interesting back and forth and some pushback. And then a guy called Andy Edwards, who, as far as I can make out, was a drummer in a band and then became like a music producer. And he's had like quite a lot of experience and now he does stuff on YouTube talking about popular music. He then, as I would expect somebody from his background to do, pushed back and said, well, okay, academic agent, but what about this, 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 and this? You say all of this stuff is top down, but what about all of these counterexamples and what about these things that happened that were genuinely organic? And also, some of these musicians that you're talking about, they were genuinely talented. So, he made this kind of long, by his own admission, quite rambling video, and now I'm going to respond to him. To be honest, I thought Andy Edwards's video was pretty good. It was he was not as dismissive as I thought he would be at first, and he actually came to the similar conclusion as me, albeit from a slightly different angle, that indeed Doug Morris was responsible, or one of the people chiefly responsible for hip hop overtaking rock. Through the decisions that he took in the late 90s there. But also, as you would expect, Andy Edwards had quite a bit to push back on. And I thought that I would take the time to reply to him and address some of the points that he made. One of the early points that I can deal with very quickly that he mentioned is that, well, because I'm quote unquote coming from the right, anybody who watches this channel knows I don't really like talking about left and right. I'm a sensible centrist, etc., etc. But because of that, there's some kind of racial angle here to what I'm talking about. That is not the case. What I'm actually trying to figure out is to what extent, genuinely an empirical question, to what extent is popular culture and is culture in general a top-down phenomenon rather than a bottom-up democratic thing, okay? I discuss this, among other things, in my book, The Populist Delusion. Buy it now. But it's a genuine interest of mine because the kind of the mythos that we inherited from the boomer generation that he talks about, that Andy Edwards talks about, the kind of idea that they had was that everything is kind of bottom up. That people had a problem with, what was happening in America. Then they went to a few protests, and oh, as if by magic, the culture changed from the bottom up. Actually, the reality is, everywhere and always, the organized minority overcomes the disorganized mass, and many of the things that we're told that are quote unquote democratic triumphs were actually the result of dedicated activists, political operatives, and so on the ground. And in fact, there's hard evidence in many of these cases for that. I mean, one example off the top of my head was Rosa Parks, which has got a mythos about it, and the guy she was sitting next to on the bus and so on actually was a well-known journalist and a progressive and someone who was on his side. And Rosa Parks was not some like innocent woman. That old thing with the back of the bus idea was a staged event, from Rosa Parks and her group. She was an activist. Now, whatever you make of her cause, what you have to say is that was effective. And what was also effective was selling the idea that this was a bottom-up protest. Actually, it was pretty well orchestrated. Now, what I want to talk about in my reply here to Andy is I actually think that he brought up a few really interesting points. that I should deal with, okay? Because my tendency is to say you have to look at the power structure and you have to look at many of the things that reach your eyes as an inorganic top-down imposition. And his pushback was actually quite nuanced, and I think it's worth going through the model that he comes up with, okay? If I understand Andy Edwards correctly, his point is that a lot of the time, the money men, so the way he describes it, the money men, the likes of Doug Morris and so on, they've always got this dream of turning music into like a factory output. You know, Andy described it as a factory output. So basically a capitalistic mode of production where you can churn out product in a reliable manner, okay, to make money. Okay, just like you're making cans of beans or something like that and flogging them in the supermarket, you're pumping out generic songs or generic albums in order to sell them by the millions. As against the artistic, creative people who are into music, who are actually in it for the love of what they're doing and, you know, to make interesting stuff that, you know, may or may not take off, quote unquote, organically. Now, the way Andy described the history of jazz and the history of hip hop was actually similar. His argument is that jazz actually took off as an organic form, not in the 1910s, where there were these seven publishing firms that I pointed to that were based in New York, who then had this push that I described in my video. All of the things I talked about in my video actually happened, by the way, including machinations to get that guy into Carnegie Hall and all of the rest of it. All of that stuff is a matter of fact. In fact, I've got a book here. Find that book. It's called Hole in Our Soul. It's actually like a pro jazz book. Hold on. This book here by maybe I can show you this, by Martha Bayles, Hole in Our Soul, goes through this in a manner that is pro jazz, okay? So some of the concerns he had, well, this guy is a conservative, he's against subversion, etc. That's one angle you can put on it. Like old Julius Evola, whose books you can see there, that was his tactic, or Henry Ford when he was talking about jazz. That's what those guys were concerned about. This tells exactly the same story. Okay, the only difference between the story this tells and the story that Evola and Ford tell is that where Ford and Evola say this and this was bad, Martha Bayles says all of this stuff happened and this was good. Okay, what they agree on is the facts, which is how it happened, who was involved in pushing it, you know, the fact that it was an organized minority and so on and so forth. So that's one thing. Hold on, you see, now I'm rambling. You see, it's different talking to camera. I've only started doing these to camera pieces, and it's much more kind of stream of consciousness. But anyway, Andy Edwards argues that in the 1890s, really, was when jazz got going as an underground, organic thing that was popular in clubs and amongst, you know, all sorts of different people. And it was only about 20 years later that the money men in New York, you know, those publishing firms I mentioned, got hold of the idea and wanted to make buck with it, okay? That's how long it takes. Similarly, when he was talking about hip-hop, he talked about, you know, Africa, Bambaataa, and the late 70s, and then some of the early 80s breakthrough acts, like the Sugar Hill Gang and Grandmaster Flash and so on. You know, those were organically popular in their areas, and it took the money men about 20 years, you could say, from that point to Doug Morris and Eminem and all of that sort of stuff in the late 90s to break that from being simply something that was happening in the quote-unquote black community or in the ghetto to, you know, a nationwide or even a worldwide phenomena. Okay, so Andy Edwards basically argues, or he accepts, that that process, once the money men take over, is actually top down and inorganic. Okay, that there is a there's an extent to which, yes, they are making, after a certain point, they are the ones making it happen through their decisions, through that top down structure. And I mean, I had to laugh at one point. He actually talked about himself working on some sort of contract or a government contract. I can't remember exactly what he said. And going out and finding talent, rap talent, among the urban youth. Okay, so he was presenting that as a bottom up thing, but actually he'd been sent by power to pick up talent. They were like, well, they were making that happen. If they'd wanted it, like, let's say there's a different scenario where they send Andy Edwards out to find ukulele players. Right, let's just pretend that some massive George Formby fan, Frank Skinner is an example, is a massive George Formby fan, right? And he wants to bring back ukulele playing across the country as a genuine British folk tradition. He could have sent Andy Edwards out to find ukulele players around the country. That didn't happen. That was an alternative reality, a road not taken. You could say, well, the thing is, AA, ukulele playing's not popular. Hasn't been popular since the 1930s and 40s. It's had its day. Okay, well, you could say, well, yeah, but also it's not pushed. Right? You could say, well, if you pushed ukulele playing and George Formby, let's just say for 2 years straight, every BBC show, every film, you know, every Channel 4, like you run a pile of Channel 4 documentaries, you have big top line profile interviews with Frank Skinner talking about like Formby. You have Radio 1 playing George Formby songs on the hour, every hour. You have Top of the Pops. I don't think Top of the Pops is a thing anymore, but you have like Top of the Pops doing George Formby, whatever the equivalent is now, playing George Formby, MTV and VH1 on the hour, every hour. You know, when I'm cleaning windows, you could have it. What other examples can I think of as things that they could do to really push the ukulele playing? You understand where I'm going with this? And then after that process, a big one would be like X Factor or that thing with Tom Jones, The Voice. Let's say the candidate, he wants to do George Formby songs. And you have the winner, right? This would be the thing. The winner of Britain's Got Talent, or the winner of X Factor, is a ukulele player. Okay, so you could see how, using these mechanisms, if you wanted to manufacture a massive ukulele comeback, you could do it. And then the government or whoever, some record label, could say to Andy Edwards, Andy, look, rap, that's done. Like, we're done with the urban youth stuff. Go out and find me ukulele players. And At the end of that whole process, would Andy still be saying, well, that all of that was organic? This happened because people just absolutely love ukulele music. Or did it happen because basically a few key decision makers made it happen? So that is one thing I would say, that I do think that along the way, I think maybe because he's quite close to the situation, or he knows the industry quite well, and he has an insider's view, that he may miss some of the ways in which this actually is truly a top-down thing. I mean, I can imagine him thinking, yeah, but you could do all of that stuff with the ukulele stuff, but people just don't like ukulele music that much. They'd never fall for it. Why not? I mean, if you go back to my jazz example, those guys who were very skeptical about jazz in the 1910s, you know, the readers of the Dearborn Independent, who were conservative and stuffy, 10 years later would have wanted to be part of high society, were then extolling the virtues of jazz, or they wanted to be seen with the right people. So the incentives had changed. And just like those New York firms in the 1910s were able to change the incentives around jazz, if we wanted to try to engineer a scenario to change the incentives around ukulele music, it could actually be done. right? And I can foresee a world because people are impressionable, right? This is maybe at the heart of the problem here. Andy wants to see the popularity of things as a function of their intrinsic value, okay? And I understand that because he loves this music. At one point he said, I don't understand jazz or modal jazz or whatever because I'm not sophisticated enough. That's true. I hold my hands up and say, that's true. I'm not a musician. I do argue, I mean, as someone who sells a logic course here, I do wonder about the logic of that. Like, for example, you know, nobody sells a car and says, to really, really get this car, you have to be into car design or you have to be a mechanic. Right? It doesn't work like that for some reason. But for jazz, you really have to kind of, you know, play the saxophone or something to truly appreciate what's going on. So, you know, I'm still skeptical about the argument. I'd also say that I'm not like 100% against jazz artists. One of my favourites from the 1920s is a guy called Leo Reisman. I like Leo Reisman and his orchestra. I like Cole Porter, if you call his stuff jazz. It's kind of like a nebulous category but beyond a certain point, it's like, well, where does jazz become pop and so on and so forth? But I think Andy may have like twigged on that and been like, well, actually, he's got Miles Davis in his sights or something like this. Okay, but even then, there are still some. You know, I like what's her name? What's that one with the coffee? Peggy Lee, the coffee one. I mean, these are probably outrageously mainstream picks by me, but I'm not like totally against jazz. The point is that it doesn't matter, okay? It doesn't matter if you like jazz, dislike jazz, like rock, dislike rock, like rap, dislike rap. I'm trying to do a value-free analysis here where the actual intrinsic values of those things or what you make of them is irrelevant. What is relevant is how did these things become prominent? It's almost more like a scientific question that we're trying to answer. And I mean, okay, so to go back, I have rambled quite a lot now as well, okay? Andy, I understand anybody doing pieces to camera, I now understand that you ramble a lot more than if you've got the PowerPoint, you know, template that I usually use. But he wanted to come up with a model where something organically develops, let's say jazz in the 1890s, or hip-hop in the 1970s and 1980s. And then, you know, it can only get so big without the kind of commercial scaffolding around it. But the point is, it's organic. It's real. It's coming from the bottom up. It's bubbling up from the creativity of the artist. And actually, I accept that. I accept that that may well happen, okay? But then he wants to say that then the money men get hold of it, but by the time they get hold of it, the form has already gone through a kind of Spengarian cycle. The real kind of creative vitality of it has already kind of, you know, it's already on the downward swing, something like this, because, you know, and it's being turned into product and flogged to the masses. I could kind of come to a compromise with Andy that I could say, well, yes, this is kind of what happened, that there is something real and organic, and then the money men take hold of it, and yet maybe something is lost in the transition, but it kind of has to happen, otherwise, you know, none of these people would make it big, quote unquote. And the other thing that Andy wanted to talk about along the way is that, okay, this is a reality. The money men, who are just purely profit driven, they want to turn music into like a sausage factory, and these things kind of go against the natural creativity of the artist and so on. Yes, these things happen, Andy wants to say, but you still get individual geniuses that make their way through that almost despite the system. Louis Armstrong is one of his examples. He talks later about Led Zeppelin, and he talks about various other artists as well. And you know, one of the things that really interested me, which is why I'm doing this reply actually, is he suggested that there was a little golden period between, let's say, 1965 or 1964, you know, the kind of 60s high point of Dylan, Beatles, Rolling Stones and so on, where the record companies didn't really know what they were doing, right? They'd managed to create the Sausage Factory in the 40s and the 50s with Elvis and with the kind of the first kind of wave of rock and roll, and with likes of Sinatra and the and that scene. They had actually managed to make the Sausage Factory, okay? They'd have artists like signed to labels, and they'd have to almost like a mirror of the Hollywood studio system. They'd managed to produce on the music side. I mean, Ella Fitzgerald is someone who comes to my mind who became almost like a kind of machine artist, right? I'm not trying to take away from Ella Fitzgerald. I'm just saying she was signed to one of these contracts and pumped out albums and so on. She was almost kind of somebody, an artist from that era who had one of those sort of contracts. What Andy Edwards was saying is that almost despite the system, there was a period in the 50s, in the 60s, 70s and 80s, and into the 90s as well, where the artists actually had the rub of the green, because the money men didn't know what they were doing, or they weren't quite aware of the true dynamics at play. And in a way, the preeminence of hip-hop overtaking rock, although he didn't say this, but I think this is where he was going, because it's better for the business end, because it's easier to manage, because it's you know, much more of a kind of production cycle, especially if you have an in-house producer, than dealing with a band and all of its problems, and all of its not inconsistencies, but unreliability. Unreliability would be the word I'd use. Because of all of that, you know, hip hop in a way, and even more than hip hop, that model of the Beyonce and the Rihanna with the featured rapper, where you have like the R&B singer with a rapper and the in-house production, which was perfected in the 2000s. And let's say you have a superstar producer, the Neptune, say, or what was that guy's name? Pharrell Williams. He's just like a superstar producer. He's going to generate a hit for you. You give the lyrics to the Beyonce to sing. You have the featured rapper come in for some like additional star value. It's a hit after hit after hit. It's a hit factory. The Sausage Factory is remade. And if I understood Andy Edwards correctly, he was arguing that there was a little period there in the 60s, 70s and 80s where the artists had the run of the green. And this flip but to rap and the hip-hop production model was in a way the studios taking back control. The Sausage Factory returned, if you want to put it that way. Because the model they use is always the same. They get a writer, an in-house writer, to write the hit, as opposed to it being Lennon and McCartney or Bob Dylan or, you know, Led Zepp or whoever. Somebody else is writing the song. And this is one of the things, I was actually into rap in the 90s and the 2000s. One of the things I noticed so often is that Jay-Z would ghostwrite the lyrics of various different rappers. I was like, what's going on? You're a rapper, you can't come up with your own lyrics? Why is Jay-Z writing the lyrics? And then it twigged. Oh, hold on a second. Jay-Z is the record label owner. He wants the royalties. They want the royalties going to Jay-Z. So if you can imagine, you've got the in-house producer, you've got the in-house rapper, like the Jay-Z, the lyricist, and what they've done is they've recreated that model they were going for in the 1910s in New York, where typically New York would provide the lyricist and the music writer, and the jazz artist would basically be a star to stick in front of the screen, right? It was almost like it was the Britney Spears model, which Andy Edwards also mentioned. So anyway, in a funny way, we've ended up agreeing more than disagreeing. I still think my emphasis is more on the top-down side, and Andy Edwards' emphasis is more on the bottom-up side, okay? But there is, I mean, let's... Okay, real life is messy, right? No one model easily describes everything. And he is right to say that when those organic scenes are cropping up, that is happening of its own accord. I would agree with him there. Where I think he may have a bit more of a blind spot is once the money men are in and up and running, how much of them, what happens, can truly be described as quote-unquote organic. Okay, and again, it's not a value judgment. It's not like top-down bad, bottom-up good, or bottom-up good, top-down bad. This is really about trying to accurately describe what is actually happening. I'd be very interested to see if Andy replies to this, to see what he makes of the notion of whether George Formby, right, whether ukulele playing, when I'm cleaning windows, all of that, what can that, could that be brought back using the pure top-down psyop techniques? Let's just say in Britain, right, use my scenario. You have a ukulele player, wins Britain's Got Talent or X Factor or any of these sorts of shows. You have massive high-profile media spots from Frank Skinner talking about how much he loves George Formby. You have Radio 1 and various other stations pushing Formby on the hour, every hour. Okay, and I wonder, because one of the things that Andy talked about is that everything always starts out as novelty. Novelty, it's a novelty first and then it becomes serious. Well, I can imagine a scenario where, as a novelty, ukulele playing comes back. Because this really would go to the limits of what is top-down and organic, and what is top-down and is able to be pushed, and what is bottom-up and organic, okay? And also, how much of it, this is a really interesting question, how much of it is intrinsic? Because this is another argument that Andy made. He was actually trying to argue that there's an intrinsic quality, you know, rhythm or something. Like he's got examples of why some musics predominate over others. Why did the public eventually have a preference for jazz over classical music, as one example? And he was saying that he was tapping into something primal. It was tapping into to real rhythm, something like this. I'm kind of skeptical of that. I'm of the tendency to think, actually, you can get the public to buy anything at all, even if it's objectively like noise or something. You can get the public to buy it within certain parameters. And my evidence for that would actually be rap and hip hop. I mean, I can imagine playing rap and hip hop to somebody in the 1950s or something, and then being absolutely horrified. How could people ever like that? I know people who cannot believe that other people listen to rap. They absolutely despise it. And yet, millions and millions of people have gone out and bought it. Something broke in that. You could say, well, partly as an intrinsic result of rap. I just think it's because it's been pushed. Okay, so my test case, my challenge to anybody who watches this video is the George Formby. If you don't know who George Formby is, go and look him up and see, could he be brought back now with enough pushing, right? If Joe Rogan suddenly come out and said, do you know what? I've been listening to this guy, George Formby. I can't get enough of it. I actually can't get enough of it. I'm going to buy a ukulele and start doing George Formby stuff, right? Just imagine it. Because these are all the sorts of things that Edward Bernays would have done. He would have been like, right, well, we need to how to hack a culture. We need to get like really people like other people. They talk about this in pro wrestling as well. If they wanted to get something over in pro wrestling, they'd stick them with Hulk Hogan. They'd say, this is Hulk Hogan got a new friend, and Hulk Hogan would give them the rub. He'd transfer his heat, his energy, his popularity over to another wrestler. Okay, they used to do it with Stone Cold Steve Austin. Before those guys, they used to do it with Bruno Sammartino in pro wrestling. Well, so it is in pro wrestling, so it is in life. And that's what Edward Bernays did. The celebrity endorsement. He can transfer a little bit of his popularity, Joe Rogan, to the ukulele or to George Formby today. And lo and behold, people are impressionable. People will be, oh, well, you know, organically, I like the ukulele, actually. you know, Joe Rogan mentioned it, and actually I started listening to it. I really like George Formby. Guess my challenge to you. Anyway, pick up a course at the academic agency, and I'll see you next time, folks. I'll be interested to see where this conversation goes.
If you liked this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.